from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Support for the legislature today is provided by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Learn more at aarp.org/WV. The Charleston Gazette Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. Lumos Networks, online at lumosnetworks.com. Marshall University, with more than 100 degree programs offered in 4 locations and online. More about the Marshall family at marshall.edu. Orion Strategies, professional public relations, government affairs, creative services, and research and polling, with offices in Charleston, Buchanan, Martinsburg, Pittsburgh, and Columbus.
Good evening and welcome to the Legislature Today. Tonight, a discussion of the administration's plan on tackling the state's substance abuse crisis. But first, senior reporter Dave Mistich joins me for an update on this afternoon's news. Dave, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The governor gathered the press corps this afternoon for a press conference. He wants to distance himself from the Senate's omnibus comprehensive education bill. He even slipped and called it ominous at one point. He reiterated that this was not his bill, that he has introduced, and it has been introduced, a 5% pay raise for all public employees, and he just called the rest of what's happening here in the Senate nonsense, a food fight, and he wanted it to stop.
That's right. You know, and the governor, he did introduce his pay raise bill. That's known as Senate Bill 455. And like you said, people that would confuse the governor's bill with what's happening in the Senate, he basically said that he wants to keep it out of the way for right now. He urged the Senate to go ahead and run his pay raise bill, but you know, has some concerns. He listened to them off. Particularly, it was the issue of paycheck protection, the establishment of public charter schools, as well as the non-severability clause. So the governor taking issue with a lot of the big provisions of the Senate Bill 451. We sat there in the governor's press conference today, and we'll take a look right now of what he said during that news conference.
The reason all of you are here is just this. The reason that there's so much talk around our state, you know, the reason of the uncertainty of, well, where does the governor really stand? Do you mean to tell me this omnibus bill that's up there is the governor's bill? Well, it's not. It's not the governor's bill. You have the governor's bill. My bill was just as clean could possibly be. My bill said just do this. Give the 5% pay raise. Give it to all state employees. That was my bill. My bill didn't have with it all the bells and whistles of what we have today, and my bill was just not this. You know, I believe when you have the opportunity to give, you ought to give. You ought not give and put a receipt in the box. I mean, that's all there is to it.
Now, the governor did say there were components of this that should be hashed out. It should be hashed out separately. He called the non-severability clause a poison pill and not too pleased.
That's right. And one of the things we need to point out is that, you know, the governor's, you know, all of these issues that have come up, they have been opposed by the unions. Should point out that a lot of the leaders of these unions were in there during the press conference and cheered whenever Governor Justice was first asked whether or not he would veto Senate Bill 451, kind of walked around that, didn't give a direct answer, was asked again in a follow-up question, and then said that he would veto the bill in its current state. I also, you know, me personally, I asked him whether or not he sees this bill as a means of retaliation against what for the teachers for striking last year. He kind of led up to that, sort of implied that walked that back and then kind of said again that it was a hitting back is sort of the phrase that he used about this bill. So all kinds of things that the governor said today seeming to lie in the favor of the educators, of the education unions, and very much trying to distance himself from the Senate and their version of the education reform bill.
And even before this press conference took place, the Senate president had arranged for his own press opportunity right after that. Let's take a listen to this.
I honestly feel like he's mistaken, that if you really want to change this system, if you care about our children and our kids and their education process, that you will want to approach this. You want to provide leadership and not hold everyone back from doing a fundamental overhaul of our system. And if, you know, it's pretty easy just to sit down and say, I want to do a pay raise and I just want the Senate to do our bill and I don't want to do any reform and look at that later or maybe do it in a separate bill and, you know, if, ands, buts, all that kind of thing. We want to provide a world-class education for our students. That's our sole motivation, and I believe the parents and the students and the teachers in this state want the same thing.
And Suzanne, Senate President Mitch Carmichael, he added, whenever reporters were gathered there in the Senate chamber following Governor Justice's press conference, that they are committed to the pay raise. Now, he stopped short of actually saying that he would run the governor's bill separately while the Senate works out the details on Senate Bill 451. But earlier in the Senate, there was a lot of conversation about this bill. Of course, tomorrow, the Committee of the Whole, the entire body, essentially a 34-member committee, will meet in the Senate to take it up in lieu of the Senate Finance Committee that was supposed to take the bill up upon second reference. As we all know, it's likely that that bill's fate would have sent it by the wayside had that bill gone to the Finance Committee based on votes that had been counted. We heard from various senators on this bill, particularly we'll start with Senator Rucker, who announced some changes to that bill, one provision that's actually going to be taken out. We'll take a look at some of the action in the Senate right here in this clip.
The class size change that was proposed in Senate Bill 451 is going to be removed in the committee substitute that we are going to be debating here. And the reason it's going to be removed is because we no longer find a need to provide that greater flexibility that was being asked to us. Because of the base level funding that we are giving to the counties who are losing students, and because we have many measures in the bill that provide flexibility to the counties, we don't see any need to change the class sizes.
My concern is, as we walk through this process, let's do not decimate a fragile public education system in this bill. It's wrong. Let's not disrespect those 20,000 educators, the ones that came before them and the ones that'll come after. I won't debate many bills this session, but I will debate you all on every step of this bill. I read your biographies last night, the whole majority party, and they're very impressive. But a very small percentage of you all that sit in the majority, based upon what is in your bios, have had little to no direct engagement in public education in the past 5 years.
First of all, everyone wants to talk about skipping the Finance Committee. I get calls on it. I've seen a member's comment that's been in this body for more than 10 years comment on, we're skipping the Finance Committee. We're not skipping the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee is in this room, and there's more people. It's a better Finance Committee because it has 34 people, not 17.
And so, Dave, a big day on this bill tomorrow.
That's right. Again, the Senate will act as the Committee of the Whole. They'll all come in and consider the bill under the normal process. We should note that a fiscal note just came in on the bill today. It puts that the fiscal impact at $137 million for Senate Bill 451. Senators were waiting on that to come in for the committee. I should point out that as of now, they have not appointed a chair. There's been some talk that Senator Craig Blair, since he chairs the Finance Committee, might head up the Committee of the Whole. We'll see how all that plays out, and they will go through this process in essentially a double-sized version of the Finance Committee tomorrow. And then after that, there will be normal floor action, three readings. The second reading will have the amendment stage, just like normal. So looking forward to the rest of the process, play on this bill, and see if they have the votes to get this passed in the Senate.
Okay, and we'll be following it tomorrow. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks.
Next, the Justice Administration's strategy in addressing the state's opioid crisis. Health reporter Kara Lofton spoke with Bob Hansen, director of the Office of Drug Control Policy, and Brian Gallagher, chair of the Governor's Advisory Council on Substance Use Disorder.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. We're here to talk about substance abuse and drugs in West Virginia, which is obviously a huge problem. And you two are on the forefront of trying to tackle that issue and change the trajectory, basically. Bob, you are new in your position. Talk to us a little bit about your goals for the job and what you hope to accomplish this year.
Well, that's a good question. Really, my first goal has got to be to reduce overdose fatalities. I think that's got to be foremost in our minds, is to reduce the number of people that are passing away due to the drug epidemic. So that's got to be the number one priority. There are a lot of other things that we need to be tackling, but that's got to be the first thing on our plate.
And in that vein, I know that West Virginia has announced recently that they will be doubling the number of treatment beds in the state. That's huge. Why the focus on treatment beds specifically?
Well, that growth in treatment beds really starts with the passage of the Ryan Brown Act and the funding for those beds several years ago. So these programs have been in development over the last year and now are going to be coming online throughout 2019. So that's a big resource for us because we're almost doubling the number of residential treatment beds in our state.
The importance of treatment beds can't be overstated, really, because as Bob was saying, we save people's lives by giving them naloxone, then we go and try to get them into treatment, and that's the next step. So the rate-limiting step right now is having an adequate number of treatment providers and beds to be able to get people into treatment, and that's the next step on the road to recovery.
And so, I mean, when we're talking about the road to recovery, I think one of the important pieces that we often don't talk about as much is preventing people from needing recovery in the first place. So, you know, where does that fit in when you're looking at sort of the things that we're doing right now?
Well, I'm sure Brian has an answer, but we really have to pay attention to prevention. But it's, you know, we're going to have multiple priorities, and prevention has to be one of those type items that we work with. So it's something we need to address. We need to figure out, you know, what are evidence-based practices in the prevention realm and work with many community partners like the boards of education and community agencies to really, you know, be effective in preventing individuals, our youth, go down the path of substance use disorders.
Preventing is really mission critical to what we're trying to do, because Bob and I talk about it all the time. Our job in these new roles is to put ourselves out of business, because as a pharmacist, addiction is an on-off switch. Once you turn it on, you can't turn it off. You can dim it, but you can't turn it off. And so the goal's got to be to prevent people from getting addicted in the first place, and then you avoid all of these problems. But as Bob said, we got to address this thing. Beginning, you can't help somebody if they're dead. So we've got to start with that and then work our way into this. But your point's well taken. Prevention is absolutely critical to what we're trying to do.
I mean, you guys know that prevention is a big deal, but prevention is notoriously difficult to fund. You know, it's much easier to get funding for treatment beds or something, but when you're looking at funding prevention for even something like diabetes or heart disease, that's difficult. I mean, is there legislature that could help us basically prevent the generation that hasn't become addicted yet from becoming that way?
Well, a couple of years ago, the legislature passed a bill that requires education and training in the schools for students to help them with coping skills for prevention. But Bob hit the nail on the head. The issue is, what is an evidence-based program? There's a lot of programs out there that the data doesn't support that they do anything. So if we make a bad decision, get a bunch of teachers trained, get a lot of students educated on things that don't work, that's not a good move. And so, as Bob was saying, we've got to try to find out what actually works, put our money there, and then get the students the coping skills that they need to work on prevention.
And whatever strategies we are working on, we got to stick with them. You know, prevention is not like a quick fix. I think it's building that skill set, the resiliency skills that our youth need. So that takes a longer period of time. But the big issue with prevention is how do you measure effectiveness and having good outcome data, and that's very difficult.
The reality is that we are dealing with a large population of people who are struggling with already being addicted. So are you working on any policy around substance abuse prevention and treatment specifically?
Well, we talked about prevention. I think on the treatment side, the residential bed increase this year is going to be great, but also we've got to expand medication-assisted treatment and other outpatient services throughout our state. I think one of our goals, it has to be that we have services and treatment available in every county in some fashion. So we need to improve access, because people who need help need it quickly, and we've got to work on the access issue and increasing our treatment options.
Yeah, so medication-assisted treatment, there's a bit of controversy about that, and you know that needs to be addressed as well, because again, as a pharmacist, the closest a disease state that comes to mind that's analogous to that is depression. It's not the same by any stretch of the imagination, but there's basically three ways of going down with treating depression. There's some people that are able to fight through it without medication. There's some people that need to be on medication for a relatively short period of time. And there's some people that are going to have to be on the medication for a longer period of time. And it's the same thing with this. So we have three medications that we can use. Some people will not need medication. Some people can be weaned off of the medication. Some people will need have it for longer term. But it's not back in the days when methadone was the only thing that we had. Now we've got two other very effective drugs. But again, like so many disease states, there's a number of different drugs that work better for one person than work better for another, or therapy.
And even though we're emphasizing medication-assisted treatment, I think we both believe that that it's an individual decision, and there should be many pathways to recovery. That includes abstinence-based, faith-based, medication-assisted treatment. Whatever works for that individual is something that we need to encourage and foster in our state.
Medication-assisted treatment is still controversial in many circles, including in members of the legislature. I mean, is expanding access to MAT central to basically your plan of attack for dealing with this?
Importantly, it's a very important arrow in our quiver, for want of a better term. It's evidence-based. It's shown that it does work. And so there's a lot of studies, a lot of good data. Federal government's releasing a lot of money to support medication-assisted treatment. Why? Because it works. And so are some things better for one patient than another? Absolutely. But we've got to use that, and because it is evidence-based and something that's going to help these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And sometimes, though, I mean, one of the things that we come up against, especially with something like health and mental health specifically, is it can be evidence-based, but there is still stigma surrounding a practice. So when we talk about treating substance use disorder, part of it is really just treating perception of how people became addicted and how they should be treated. How do you do that?
That's a great question, but we really have to look at it and attack it from many different angles and really educate key stakeholders throughout our state, be it employers, key business people. I mean, just providing education and also letting people who have lived experience, who are in recovery and in working back in our communities, if they're willing, have them share their stories, you know, that recovery is possible. And, it's something that we just need to continue to work on. I think we've made progress as a state over the last year, but we still obviously have a long way to go.
It's one of the things that makes this problem so complex in trying to address, because there's a whole spectrum of people. Not everybody got to addiction by the same route. There's a role for law enforcement. There's people that have substance use disorder that need to go to jail. But that's not everybody. And before we were saying we can arrest our way out of this. There's a whole bunch of people that got substance use disorder because they got injured at work. They took the drug exactly the way the doctor prescribed it, exactly the way the pharmacist dispensed it, and they got this because they followed instructions. We need to help them all we can. And there's a whole array of people, not all patients, but there are a wide array of different approaches that have to be taken to this, not only on the side of treatment, but then after they pass through the addiction, they need different supports after you get through with this. Some person need a job. Some people need job training. And some people need housing. All of these different things. It's a very complicated problem to address.
That's a good segue. We have a number of grants that have recently been awarded, one of which is something called Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. Can you guys talk to me a little bit about that and sort of how, if you know, how that's been going so far?
Well, I think we're standing up lead programs in four or five counties around the state right now. And so we've had a lead program in Kanawha County and in Cabell County for a number of years. And the data that's been collected is that diverting people outside into treatment instead of going through the criminal justice process works.
So the idea would be that a law enforcement officer, instead of arresting somebody, would say,
yes,
you have the option to go to treatment.
That is correct. And it's working. And the data, especially as I understand it here in Kanawha County, has been quite phenomenal. And that's led us to fund projects throughout the state. And they're just in the beginning stage of developing. So it'll be really exciting about 6 months from now to see the impact that they have in their communities.
And it helps feed into the anti-stigma portion too. When you've got prosecutors and you've got policemen and you've got judges and you've got people say in the criminal justice system saying, this is a good thing because these people need help and we're going to do a lot more to get them back into society by putting them into treatment than we are putting them into jail. That helps convince people that would be more tougher on the law enforcement side of things.
And that's why everybody needs to work together. Everybody has a role to play. In Huntington, the mayor would say that all hands on deck, and I think that's the same for the state too, is, you know, law enforcement and the judicial system, healthcare providers, citizens in our community, the faith community. You know, we've got to pull together and really work towards common goals. It's a complex problem, but if we pull everybody together, I think we can make some significant progress.
So we are in the beginning of the legislative session. I've heard about two rumored legislative bills that, like, you could comment on. I've heard that you might be working to change the rules that govern who is allowed to practice MAT and getting more providers trained. Part of the issue is that a lot of primary care physicians don't feel comfortable prescribing it, and that would greatly relieve sort of the stigma because, you know, you don't know if somebody's coming in to get treated for strep throat or get MAT.
Well, without that, the cycle that we're in right now is somebody gets naloxone. We send out a quick response team within 24 hours. They talk to this person. They say, yeah, I want to get off of this. That was one of the scariest things of my life. I don't want my kids to go through this again. And if you don't have a place to send them to treatment, you're going to send them back out on the street, and it's naloxone again, quick response team, and we're in this endless loop, and it doesn't work. So we got to get providers to primary care providers. So the way we're approaching this in Huntington, what Marshall is saying, the best way to do this is to get primary care providers to treat these patients with the disease like other patients in their practice. So somebody who has heart disease also has substance use disorder, the primary care physicians would need to help with that. So what we're trying to do, and we're not exactly sure what form or fashion legislation this year or maybe next year would take, but is try to remove barriers for primary care providers to be able to provide medication-assisted treatment.
And that could be training, it could be being available for consultation, you know, and assistance. So whatever we can do to spread availability of services, treatment services, throughout the state so it's accessible to individuals who need them, that's what we've got to work on.
So one thing that has been, I mean, to continue to talk about controversial things around harm reduction, or around this, is harm reduction. So is there going to be, I heard at one point that there might be some legislation to sort of regulate different harm reduction programs. Do you know anything about that? And what role does harm reduction play in this?
Well, again, as somebody who's trained in science, I'm about evidence-based programs. And the evidence supports that harm reduction programs are effective. Now, that doesn't reflect necessarily what society might think is the right thing for their community. And so I think these are decisions that need to be made on a local basis, what people in the community are comfortable with and comfortable supporting. I can talk to people about the science, but if they're still opposed to it, we shouldn't be in a position of forcing things down people's throats.
And I agree with that. And also, we've learned in Huntington that harm reduction is a great gateway to treatment. Because by having a peer recovery coach in an harm reduction program, as people decide to change and they want to go down the path of treatment, being there to help them and assist them and getting into a program, it's another way to get people into treatment programs. So it's another great avenue for doing that.
Yeah, in Huntington, we have a peer recovery coach, and the gentleman is very effective in helping people get into treatment. Yeah. And their numbers are, I don't have them off the top of my head, I don't know if you do, Bob, but the numbers are really, they're very successful when people come into these needle exchange programs in getting them into treatment.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, you know, getting West Virginia toward a direction of recovery is a multi-tiered approach, and that the legislative approach needs to look at funding prevention, but also at the simultaneously getting people into treatment and sort of taking this multi-pronged thing where we're working with law enforcement and addressing stigma so that the communities can work together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one thing that hasn't been mentioned, there's a big role for Jim's Dream in this whole process. Employment's a huge thing at the end. You've got to give people hope. Idle hands are the devil's workshop. You've got to, you know, people that are in despair because they can't get a job, and support their families. We've got to find ways to get people employed. And we talk in Huntington often about looking at people in recovery as an asset, not as a liability. How can we put these people into meaningful jobs? They all were doing something, or most of them were doing something beforehand. So if someone's a carpenter and they're in recovery, let's find something for them to do. If someone was a plumber, if someone was a pharmacist.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you both coming in today, and it's been a great conversation.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
And this concludes tonight's broadcast of the Legislature Today from the Capitol. I'm Suzanne Higgins. For everyone here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thanks for joining us. Have a great evening.